From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show and podcast, which is usually recorded at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. But today has been recorded at CKDU, Halifax, Nova Scotia, one of the 37 Canadian radio stations currently airing Deconstructing Dinner each week. I'm John Steinman. Just before Deconstructing Dinner hit the road for our East Coast tour, we spoke with a young entrepreneur from Vancouver who was involved in an innovative pedal-powered project this past summer that also inspired him to launch his own pedal-powered grocery delivery business. In the first half of the show, we'll hear from Martin Gunst of Grocer Gunst, and he'll also speak to us about the Market Cargo project that he participated in, which offered market goers at Vancouver farmers markets an option to have their farm fresh foods transported from the market to their home by bicycle. And in the second half of the show, the first of our recordings from our East Coast tour, although with this one featuring Vermont's Tom Stearns, the president of High Mowing Seeds, a successful organic seed business based in the small community of Hardwick. Both Tom and I shared the podium at Acadia University, where we spoke to an audience on the challenges facing our food system, and more importantly, the innovative responses to those challenges, which in Hardwick seem to be both plentiful and successful. The increasing popularity of urban farmers markets has also been accompanied by increasing challenges for market goers, which among them is finding parking. Now, it's probably safe to conclude that the accessibility challenges of some markets might limit the quantity of foods being sold at the market. And then there are the walkers and cyclists, those who are traveling to the market without much capacity to haul a large load of groceries home. Well, in comes Martin Gunst, an enthusiastic and passionate 21-year-old student at the University of British Columbia, UBC, who participated in a unique summer employment project known as Market Cargo. In partnership with the UBC Bike Co-op, Martin offered his pedal-powered services to market patrons using an 8-foot steel bicycle trailer. Martin Gunst spoke to Deconstructing Dinner over the phone from Vancouver.
I am 21 years old. From California. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I came to Vancouver after I graduated from high school. I came up to UBC. It was 2004 at the time, and I was concerned about a potential draft, a military draft in the States, and I did not want any part of that, and so I came north, and I've been going to UBC for 4 years. Market Cargo is a project of the UBC Bike Co-op. And so I got to know Kevin Cooper, who's the president of the bike co-op. I'm an avid cyclist. I ride my bike to school every day. I like cycling for fun. Market Cargo the concept was from Kevin Cooper. And the bike co-op applied for a grant to the federal government from HRDC, the Canada Summer Jobs Program, which they can hire a student for a full-time position for the summertime. And they received one of those grants to run this project, and I was hired to be the coordinator for Market Cargo. So it was not actually my concept, but I helped develop it and flesh it out with Kevin of what exactly we would do. And so Market Cargo ended up being a project that aimed at helping support local farmers and consumers who also support local farmers. So we offered a home delivery service by bicycle from two of the four local farmers markets in the summer in Vancouver. People would come to the farmers market, do their shopping, and then leave their groceries with us, and we would cycle their groceries to their home for them. The aim was that with this service, people could more easily leave their cars at home when they came to the farmers market. This way, they wouldn't be limited to how much they could carry home if they were cycling or walking, taking transit. A lot of people are not, they may be new to bicycling and they want to bike to the farmer's market, but they also want to buy their whole week's worth of produce. And they can't carry that on their back without squishing it, or they can't fit it all in their panniers. And so the UBC Bike Co-op has a fleet of cargo bicycles. We have big trailers, long-tail bikes, very large panniers, where we can put bins on the back. And we can carry iced coolers on the backs of these bikes, and so we could carry meat and fish and more sensitive vegetables home for people without damaging them. And so we did that. And then as an incentive to also get people to bike to the farmers market, because we were from the UBC Bike Co-op, we also offered free bicycle tune-ups for market patrons. Neither Kevin nor I nor our volunteers were professional mechanics, but we're all pretty apt at fixing bikes. And so we offered basic tune-up services. So we would pump up tires, align derailleurs, tighten and align brakes. We definitely drew a lot of people over to our table and to our services with that.
With the infrastructure and interest already in place to be transporting food using bicycles and trailers, Martin Gunst also did deliveries each week for the University of British Columbia's farm, which operates a community-supported agriculture, or CSA, box program. Martin even extended his services to help support a new urban farming business, which, similar to our recent feature on Nelson Urban Acres, does not own a motorized vehicle.
And then with Market Cargo, we also did deliveries for the UBC farm for their CSA program. All of their deliveries on the west side of Vancouver, every Saturday, we would deliver those boxes to people's houses. Whereas previously, they were not deliveries. Everybody who had a CSA share would come to the farm, to the UBC farm on Saturdays to pick up their box. I think generally driving, because the farm is kind of a ways away, you have to cross the endowment lands and go up a hill. We had, I think, six deliveries every Saturday, so those were six fewer car trips that were being made every Saturday. And then there was one other part of the project, which was that there was an urban farm at around 57th and Cambie, it was a new urban farm. This was their first harvest season, and they sold their produce at only one farmer's market, and one each week. And Kevin and I cycled all of their produce and all of their market gear, so their tents and their tables and chairs and tablecloths and signs, down to the farmer's market every Wednesday and then back up to the farm on Wednesday evenings. And so they were able to operate completely car-free this whole summer. All of the farmers, none of them have cars. There are five women who work the land there. And during the week to do their farming work, they would all cycle to the farm, but on Wednesdays, they were going to need a van or find some form of automated transportation to get the produce there if it hadn't have been for Kevin and I.
Now, it's quite the new idea to offer bicycle delivery services to customers of a farmer's market, which was the focus of the summer Market Cargo project. And so Market Cargo worked with the vendors to help inform market customers of the pedal-powered transportation option.
We had little quarter-sheet flyers that we had left with all of the farm vendors. We had talked with the farm vendors to let them know about our service and about how our service could benefit them. Because there are a lot of people who come to the farmers market on their bikes and may choose to buy less than they would have if they weren't on their bikes because they cannot carry a whole flat of apricots for canning or can't carry meat that needs to be on ice home with them. And so we told the farm vendors about our service and left these quarter sheet flyers. So next to most of the cash boxes at the vendors' tables, market patrons would see our flyers. Otherwise, we would try to yell at people across the market from our table and attract people to our table as best as we could. And we definitely did talk to a lot of people because seeing bike tune-ups being done at the farmer's market is not something people are accustomed to. And so we definitely drew a lot of attention that way. And we had our large cargo bicycles kind of prominently displayed next to our table, which a lot of people, I learned, had never even heard about before. A lot of people had never seen a cargo bike. And so we definitely drew a lot of attention to ourselves that way.
Martin Gunst. The idea of offering pedal-powered delivery service at a farmer's market does, of course, seem like an option that would likely catch on, especially among regular customers. But Market Cargo did not receive a level of interest that both Martin and Kevin were hoping for.
As far as the deliveries went, I would say our success was moderate. We would do, on average, I would say 2 to 6 deliveries each market. I think Kevin and I were both expecting at the beginning of the summer to be doing more than that. But that was as many as we got. We had a few regular customers. There was one restaurant in particular who we would actually do deliveries for every week. quite a large volume of food. Prior to market cargo, they would send a cook to the farmer's market in a taxi, and then they would take the taxi back to the restaurant with all of their food. After they had heard about us, they would send that cook to the farmer's market on a bicycle, and then we would bike that produce back to the restaurant for them. So that eliminated a whole car trip. But we would, so as I said, we had around 2 to 6 deliveries each week. I think that people are perhaps not used to the concept of leaving their groceries with other people to take home for them. It's not something that I've ever really seen anywhere. There were a lot of seniors, older people who would use our service. I think they were more comfortable with the idea than young people, who maybe the concept of self-sufficiency is more important to them. I'm not sure exactly what the reason for why we didn't have a very high demand for the home delivery service was. I know that we did provide, our service was good. We never failed to make any deliveries. We never damaged any goods. We had no bad reviews from anybody. I would say our success with the deliveries was moderate.
Certainly one of the challenges also faced by market cargo was the lack of diversity in foods found at the market. Even with the rising popularity of farmers markets across North America, there is still a challenge for customers to access all of their grocery needs at one market, and therefore less interest in the idea of bicycle delivery services. The Vancouver markets where market cargo was set up are an example of this, where there is little to no options for items like meat and dairy and other staple foods. And so it's the prospect of perhaps these markets expanding the diversity of the foods offered being, among other reasons, that gives him hope that market cargo will be more successful next year, and he believes the service will continue to be offered.
As far as next year, I think the project is going to happen again next year. We were not able to come up with a better way this summer of marketing the project. What I hope that came out of this project, if it was not so much that we were actually changing people's behavior from a week-to-week basis through using our service, was that we were showing people what was possible to do with bicycles, that it was possible to carry, to do all of one's shopping on a bicycle, to carry even an entire farm's worth of food and all of their gear to the market. I hope that we were inspiring people to think more seriously about using their bicycles for self-sufficiency and not feeling that they need to rely on cars for anything other than the most basic shopping needs. And so I'm hoping that kind of in the long run, people will start thinking about bicycles more in a different way than they had potentially before as leisure tools.
On today's episode of Deconstructing Dinner, we're hearing from Vancouver's Martin Gunst, a 21-year-old student at the University of British Columbia, who last year participated in the Market Cargo Project, which, among other services, offered bicycle delivery services to customers at a number of Vancouver farmers markets. A link to more information on Market Cargo, including photographs of Martin and the 8-foot bike trailers being used, is posted on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and listed under the October 1st, 2009 episode. Now, the Market Cargo Project was only operating on a few days of the week, leaving some time available for Martin Gunst to concoct yet another innovative idea using a similar philosophy. Martin launched Grocer Gunst, a pedal-powered grocery delivery business offering farm-fresh foods to customers in the city of Vancouver. The idea is certainly one that could be applied in any city, as even today, with the rising interest to support more responsibly produced foods, it's still difficult to access those foods close to home. This is exactly what inspired Martin to launch Grocer Gunst.
It was actually Carl Hahn's eggs, which I grew accustomed to eating every week when I was working with Sprouts. We would get eggs from him. It was sometime towards the end of the school year last year. I wasn't at school that day and I needed eggs. And I went to my local grocery store, an IGA in town, in Mount Pleasant, Vancouver, and I bought the free-range organic eggs. And I took them home and I made myself an omelet or something like that. And I just noticed that the eggs did not taste nearly as rich and as full as the eggs that I had gotten from Carl all year had. That the yolks were not as rich in color. The yolks were whitish. and the whites were thinner. The eggs didn't hold together as well when I cooked them. And I realized that I didn't want to go back to eating these kind of standard store-bought eggs. I really wanted to continue eating good, high-quality eggs, and I didn't really know where to find them in town. And so I called up Carl, and I asked him if he would start delivering eggs to my house. He agreed that he would, and I set up an egg-buying cooperative amongst people that I know. We had around 30 people coming to my house every week to pick up their eggs, and I was selling them for pretty much no markup. I was making 25 cents on a dozen just to get my eggs for free, basically, for my troubles. And this egg co-op became very popular, and so I started buying produce from Carl as well, and people really liked the produce. It's very high-quality stuff that you otherwise have to go to a farmer's market to get, and a lot of people can't always make it to the farmers markets, you know, in the morning, on the weekends. It's out of people's way. And I remembered the success of the Sprouts Box, which was the home produce delivery service by bicycle initiative that I helped start with Sprouts last year. And I figured, why not do the same thing? I know that a lot of people really like to eat good, fresh produce, but they don't always have time to go to the farmers markets, and it's hard to find produce of that quality in conventional grocery stores. And so it started out with just produce from Biota Farms, from Carl. And from talking with Carl, I started learning about biodynamic farming, and I became very interested in the concept behind the farming. And I got in contact with other biodynamic farmers and started Grocer Guns. So I started buying biodynamic produce every week, and putting up posters around town and putting handbills in local cafes. And pretty soon I had a bunch of regular customers, and I had my own business, and I was self-supporting this summer the first time.
Martin Gunst. Regular listeners of Deconstructing Dinner might be familiar with the source of Grocer Gunst produce and eggs, as Biota Farm has been featured on the show on two occasions now, including one of our first broadcasts back in January 2006, and then once again when we recorded Carl Hahn offering a workshop on the importance of microorganisms, and that episode aired in April 2008. Now, for Martin, it worked out well to be at the market offering the market cargo service there, because the market also then became the distribution point for the farmers supplying Martin for his Grocer Gunst business. From the market, Martin would transport his food to a space run by the Toast Collective, a collectively run space in Vancouver that helps build capacity in the community by hosting and facilitating do-it-yourself projects and workshops. And then, once a week, Martin distributes that food to his customers.
During the height of the summer, I had around 15 to 17 deliveries every Monday. Right now, I have 10 to 15 on a weekly basis. Most of them are regular customers who have been with me through the majority of the summer or from whenever they heard about me. Each week in a box, there are usually between 6 and 9 items, depending on the size of the box that you order from me. I have a small, medium, and large size boxes, and then all of them are with or without eggs. And a medium box will generally have 8 or 9 different items in them, between 1 and 3 fruits, and then the rest are vegetables. And it really depends on what is being harvested by these farmers each week. In many ways, it's like a CSA box, which probably many of your listeners know about, in which a person is a shareholder in a farm's harvest, and they get in their weekly box whatever is being harvested that week. And so because I'm buying from actually 4 to 5 farms each week, and so I get perhaps a bit more variety than a CSA shareholder would in my boxes, but I'm still limited by, these are all very small farms, and so every week there's a degree of uncertainty as far as what is going to be harvested, the quantity of the vegetables that are going to be harvested, and the quality. My small box is anywhere from $19 to $22 a week, and you get a pretty substantial amount of produce for, say, one person if you're living by yourself. The prices are comparable to what you would pay in the farmer's market, but you're getting a home delivery service included in that price. And see, on August 24th, a small box got a pound of pears, a pound of tomatoes, of heirloom tomatoes, a half pound of blueberries, a pound of mixed beans, a pound of winter squash, 2 ears of corn, and a bunch of radishes. So you actually, in many cases, I think, get more than what you would pay. You get more value for what you would pay than what you would pay at the farmer's market. For $22, I don't think you would be able to get that much at the farmer's market. So I'm actually offering very competitive prices.
Grocer Gunst also offers grass-fed meat, organic chicken, organic fertilizers, and Martin will also transport soil for any backyard gardeners in need. Now, it was inspiring to learn that Grocer Gunst is in a position to significantly expand its customer base, which in part has been helped by Martin restricting his delivery area to a small area of the city. This introduces the importance of developing food security projects that are able to view individual communities within the larger urban community. So often, food security work within cities tends to try and satisfy needs on a citywide scale. But Grocer Gunst has been successful by maintaining itself within what it sees as an appropriate scale.
I would be able to accommodate quite a few more customers if I had the interest. Right now, I've been doing this one day a week throughout the whole summer, and I could probably easily accommodate 30 customers or more even in a day, because I've limited the area to which I do my deliveries. It's kind of central East Vancouver. I deliver from Cambie in the west out to Nanaimo in the east, and then up to Hastings in the north and down to King Edward in the south. Because for the most part, all of my customers are in a fairly concentrated area, the number of boxes that I deliver, I'm not really limited to how many customers I can accommodate because it's not very far to bike. It doesn't take much time to do a delivery itself, as long as what takes time is getting out and covering distance to different deliveries. And I have, because of this job with Market Cargo, I've been able to use this 8-foot-long steel bicycle trailer all summer long, in which I can carry, I think, 16 grocery boxes on one run. So I can do quite a lot of deliveries without making too many loops over on myself. Last summer, I worked as a bicycle courier, and so I have a fair amount of experience with routing myself through the city to find the most efficient path on my bicycle. I've been thinking a lot about next summer of expanding into other parts of the city. I know I talk to a lot of people at the farmers markets about my project, about Grocer Gunst, and there was a lot of interest there, but a lot of those people live outside of my delivery area. With the way that my summer was set up this summer, I couldn't really expand to more than one day a week and do more than the one neighborhood of the city that I've been servicing. But I think hopefully next year I will be able to expand the project and cover more parts of the city and be able to reach more people with this produce.
And in closing out my conversation with Martin Gunst of Grocer Gunst, he shared yet another project that he'd like to work on for next year, launching a community-supported agriculture CSA project for Carl Han of Biota Farm. Martin's interest to support Carl is an inspiring example of the passionate concern that urban eaters are beginning to have for their local farmers, and also how that concern can so easily be directed into action.
I'm hoping this winter to set up a CSA for Biota Farm, which is the farm owned by Carl Han. Over this past year, I've become a friend of Carl's, and I've gotten to know him and about his history as a farmer better. I know that he drives into the city of Vancouver from Abbotsford 2 days a week, and on those 2 days, he is not working on his farm, which is what he likes to do and what he should be doing. He works by himself. He doesn't have hired help, and so on those 2 days, his farm is just sitting. His farm is a lot of work. He's very, I guess, hardcore, I would say, about farming biodynamically. He uses little to no mechanization. He does all of his own composting, fertilizing, planting, weeding, harvesting. His farm is set up, in a very complex manner. There are virtually no identifiable rows on his farm. His plants are all interplanted amongst each other. He has hundreds of varieties of plants. I only recognize a handful when I go out to his farm. His plants support themselves because of the biodiversity that you find on the farm. He uses no fertilizer or no pesticides, no herbicides, and so the plants get a lot of vigor from being supported by the balance of nutrients and the harboring of pests and predators in the plants that are around them. And it's a lot of work to maintain hundreds of varieties of plants and to keep it in order. And I know that he sometimes struggles with being able to do it all himself. And from what I understand about CSAs, a farmer doesn't have to spend his time or her time marketing his produce, selling his produce, going to farmers' markets, and not reliably being able to sell everything. With a CSA, a farmer has all of his or her produce pre-sold at the beginning of the season so they can plant reliably exactly as much as they're going to sell, and so they don't have to do more work than what they would otherwise have to do. I know Carl is often throwing out a lot of produce because he just can't find people to buy it, and it's excellent produce that he grows, and it's a real shame. And so I want to set up a CSA for him so that he doesn't have to spend his time commuting over the Portland Bridge and trying to sell his produce and hawk it to restaurants and to people like me who are buying it. I want him to have a reliable income, to have less risk for what he's planting. I don't want him to risk not being able to sell what he grows. And I want him to be able to do what he loves, which is working with his plants and working on this farm. And so I want to set up a CSA for him so that he can do what he does best.
You can learn more about Grocer Gunst online at grocergunst.com and view some photographs on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the October 1st, 2009 episode.
Deconstructing Dinner is made possible by the generous support from the G. Raymond Chang School of Continuing Education Certificate in Food Security at Ryerson University. The Chang School offers you food for thought in your exploration of food issues and impacts, including urban agriculture. For more information about this unique distance education program, visit ryerson.ca/CE/food security.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. However, today's episode has been recorded in Halifax, Nova Scotia at CKDU, Dalhousie University, where I recently spoke as a guest lecturer to an introductory course offered by the university's new College of Sustainability. The event marked the final leg of a Deconstructing Dinner speaking tour throughout Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and just before descending into Halifax, I spoke at Acadia University in Wolfville at an event hosted by the Acadia Community Farm, Friends of Agriculture Nova Scotia, and Bali Nova Scotia, otherwise known as the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. As part of Bali's launch here in the province, they invited Vermont's Tom Stearns to share his inspiring stories of not only his successful organic seed business, High Mowing Seeds, but also the story of Hardwick, Vermont, where Tom calls home. The small community has become a focal point of innovative food and agriculture initiatives, and following the first half of my talk in Wolfville, which deconstructed a standard North American meal, Tom shared his thoughts on the current state of our industrial and globalized food system, and how his community has responded.
I wanted just to give you a little bit of introduction of my background so you kind of know where I'm coming from with this. I started a seed company, an organic seed company, as a hobby when I was 19. Began sharing seeds with people, helped pay my way through college, got a degree in sustainable agriculture. And so this hobby grew and expanded over those years. And now it's a little bit bigger. There's people there working right now so that I can be here coming to share some of our story. But I'm in a very unique area also, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. I wanted to just first also talk a little bit about how we got to this place, because we didn't plan on it this way. Now, maybe Cargill and some of the corporations have been acting perhaps for 100 years with major strategy in mind to get us here. But you guys remember in sixth grade social studies class, I don't know what you guys do up here in Canada, it's a mystery to all of us. But
hang out in our igloos.
Yeah, exactly. So I had Mrs. Broll as a social studies teacher. I remember making dioramas in shoeboxes of hunters and gatherers, or early agriculturalists, and learning about the dawn of agriculture. And this may sound, you know, jog some memory for you, but the very first farming and the first act of farming and plowing the ground was done by priests. This was a very sacred thing that was very carefully done and cared for. And the dawn of agriculture is something that has allowed, at that time, allowed culture to flourish. Music and art, government and architecture. All of that began to flourish much more when people had more stable food supplies and could stay in one place and not be roaming all over the place following game or following the seasons and gathering food. So this is, you know, 10,000 years ago to 5,000, 6,000 years ago. But even as much as a few thousand years ago, we were still sending food all over the place. Now, one of the, you know, things that John brought up that you guys are no doubt keenly aware of is that our food travels really far right now. Now, even 1,000 years ago, we were sending food 1,000 miles, 2,000 miles away. But it was things like salt and spices and sugar. And for people who could afford it, chocolate, coffee, tobacco. They were the accents to our meal. They were not the staples of the meal. They were the things that allowed us to preserve what we were producing locally. Salt, for example, was used as a preservative. So it was sugar, primarily. And the spices, again, made a lot of sense to transport these tiny, tiny little things. And I think it still does now, and I think it still will. But the staples, and my God, how far have we come that we are shipping drinking water all over the planet? You're getting to such a core staple. I don't know if this fact is true, but I did hear last year that the amount of bottled water that was sold in the world would have been enough to solve the water issues, the drinking water issues, for clean, reliable drinking water on a permanent basis for everybody on the planet that didn't have it. Just 1 year of bottled water sales. So it's really quite a different story that we've gotten into. Okay, so then go back a couple hundred years, Industrial Revolution, oil, and this beginning of shipping everything everywhere. Again, we did not plan on doing it that way. So what we now realize is this broken world food system is not something that we set about to figure out how to mess up so royally. But we certainly have. The biggest user of energy on the whole planet. You think about the biggest issues today. Energy is clearly one. Healthcare is a big one. Climate change is another big one. Biggest user of energy on the entire planet is agriculture and the food system. I had a friend who's a broccoli farmer in California, and he shipped most of his broccoli to New York City. This is a big scale, not an organic guy. Big scale, many thousands of acres of broccoli. It cost him $3 to get a bushel of broccoli to New York City. That's $3 for the broccoli, the box, and the shipping of that box there. So we're talking about a bushel of broccoli, fresh, in a refrigerated truck, delivered 3,000 miles for $3. So when price of oil last summer went to $145 a barrel, it cost him $11 to get that same bushel of broccoli to New York City. His response was to buy land outside of New York City. And he bought 5,000 acres of land outside of New York City. He wasn't thinking about doing this for any other reason than that this made sense. If oil was going up, he needed to be closer to the markets. Just made sense. All the people who started going to farmers markets to buy locally produced spinach from people they trust when E. coli came in a couple of years ago, this was a shift for them. And there are many people that are shifting now. Not for maybe some of the reasons that diehards like all of us have been doing this already, but many more reasons, new demographics, new populations of people, and I can feel them. I can feel this consciousness shifting, and it's happening in a big, big way. The challenge that a lot of us face, especially these folks that are in not within these circles as much, is that they don't have very many good examples of what a healthy food system actually looks like. Now that they're awakening to the fact that it's broken so severely, they don't have necessarily a farmer's market that they can go to. They don't have an understanding of why it's challenging to get local food into the school lunch programs. And certainly it's very rare that they might have a CSA in their town or a place that they can connect with local farmers. What you have, at least in the United States, and I imagine here as well, is sort of a scattershot of cool things happening in agriculture around the country. You've got an interesting organization over here. You've got flourishing farmers markets in this town over here. You've got a new piece of infrastructure, like an incubator kitchen that's built so that people can come in and share and use the facility. But they are scattered around. And one of the challenges is that the food system that we have that is so broken is systemically broken. And the models that we need to help inspire us to do this better need to be systemically healthy models, not scattershot models. And so I am thrilled to hear about your region and to come here and visit this town and see any other places anywhere in the world that are ahead of the rest of us that can help lead the way towards this systemic healthy food system change. So I want to tell you a little bit about my community and some of the work that we're doing there. But I guess first I just wanted to go back to one thing. I mentioned how agriculture is the biggest user of energy on the whole planet. Well, of course it's the biggest user of water also. It's the biggest polluter of water too. And I don't just mean the stream, but I mean oceans. And in pollution in general, I don't just mean the diesel tractor that's spewing fumes out as it drives down the field, but I mean climate change. Agriculture is the biggest contributor to climate change. And health. This big debate is happening south of the border here on health care, and it absolutely drives me crazy. And the main reason why it drives me crazy is that it's all about health care and health insurance. It's not about health. CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control down in Atlanta, Georgia, came out with a study a couple of months ago that said that 70% of the people alive in the United States today are going to die from a diet-related illness. 70%, right? So that's, maybe we eat better than average here, hopefully. But that's a lot of people. And that's not E. coli and salmonella poisoning and things like that. That's diabetes and healthcare. These are chronic, long-term things. And these are things that are based on a life of eating a certain way. So if you just change all of a sudden, hopefully your body is resilient enough to be able to recover. But in many cases, a lot has been set in motion by how we've been eating for most of our lives. So here we have this global food system that is poisoning our air and water and land, that is sucking the diversity and life out of our communities, that is giving us all the same boring diet. The trouble with having strawberries anytime you want them in the grocery store is that they always taste bad. They're never fresh. Strawberries are fresh somewhere in the world, but in order to get them to you where you are, they are picked, not ripe. I mean, when was the last time you actually had an out-of-season strawberry that was even worth eating? It's barely ever. And same with many, many other things. So instead of strawberry season being something, and you guys probably do this, when strawberry season comes in Vermont, that's all I eat, a pint a day. We make strawberry this, strawberry that, whatever it is. It's on everything. It's on steaks. It's on yogurt. And then we move on to the next thing and celebrating these things. And then in wintertime, well, we've got to work with dairy and meat and all the things we preserve all year. But it's really wonderful to celebrate those things when they are fresh, when they are there, and not just have cardboard strawberries year-round. And you'll notice this when a kid eats a real strawberry for the first time or a real tomato for the first time. And if they've eaten grocery store strawberries and you see the look in their eye, or a grown-up who's never eaten a real tomato, and you see the look in their eye and realize, and they're having this experience eating this thing, and it's like this joy and sadness. The joy is, oh my God, I've never eaten a real tomato before. this is amazing. And the sadness is, what the hell have I been eating that I thought was a tomato for my whole life? And that is a casualty of this broken food system, is the fact that we don't even know what real tomatoes taste like anymore. And so we definitely don't know what a healthy food system looks like. My town has a very interesting background. And perhaps because it was passed over by so many other things, a bit of a backwaters. And perhaps this story may sound familiar to you. Janet and I were talking a lot on the way in this evening about the population, the rural distribution, the type of agriculture here, the size of the province. And it's very similar to Vermont. Vermont has no cities. It's got Burlington, which is 40,000 people. That's the biggest town in the whole state. It's the most rural state in the United States, which by U.S. definitions means a percentage of its population living in towns under 2,500. And so in Vermont, with only one city that's, or one town that's 40,000, you're probably at about 90% live in towns that are under 2,000, under 2,500. And Vermont is also pretty similar in size. It's maybe a half the size of Nova Scotia, so you got a bit of a sense of it. The town of Hardwick experienced a granite boom. It had the biggest granite mines in the world in 1880 to 1930. And what happened in the 30s is the Great Depression came, reinforced concrete was sort of coming into play a lot more, and this granite nobody needed it anymore. And so just like a big town that has a factory in it that employs most of the town and the factory leaves, Hardwick became a ghost town. And this was in the 30s, and pretty much by 1940 it was pretty empty. And again, this is a community that now is 3,000 people. Back then, the granite industry employed 14,000 people. And so now it's a community that has 500 jobs in it. So from 1940 until 1970, it was a really rough and bad scene. It was very poor, no jobs, no industry, nothing on Main Street was open. There was just empty storefronts. And it was subsistence. People were working really hard. They were logging, they were milking cows, they were farming and doing their thing. But it was a really, really hard time to be living there. And all the kids that grew up during that time got their butts worked off on the farms so hard, and none of them wanted to farm.
Tom Stearns of High Mowing Seeds, located in Hardwick, Vermont. This is Deconstructing Dinner. Tom was recorded in September 2009 speaking in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. Today's episode is archived at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the October 1st, 2009 episode. Here again is Tom Stearns.
But an interesting thing happened. In the early 70s, fleeing Kent State, fleeing the Vietnam War, was a movement of back to the landers. And Helen and Scott Nearing, before that, had moved and settled in Vermont and wrote their book, The Good Life, and many others, and eventually went over to Maine. But there was a big influx of very aspirational but inexperienced young people moving up to the kingdom. So this is the corner of Vermont where we are. It's called the Northeast Kingdom. And so it was basically they went as far away as you could go, and then they landed there. And what they found was these hard but struggling, intact communities, but that were really hard and were very much struggling still. But they had town meetings, which we still have in Vermont. They decided things as a town. They took care of each other. And Vermont is this interesting thing. In addition to being the most rural, y'all probably watch our presidential election, like especially this last one, and you see the red and blue things popping up as states win with one candidate or another. Okay, so you can look at the most rural states, and they are all red. Vermont, being the most rural state out of all 50, is the most blue. It's the most progressive and the most rural. Completely opposite from any other pattern in the rest of the country. And so you have this sort of Yankee independence that was sort of like this libertarian attitude of don't you dare tell me what to do, infused with this community spirit, probably because we have 6 months long winter, we're way the hell out there in the middle of nowhere, you don't know who you're going to need to help pull you out of a ditch or help you when you need a hand, and this community spirit mixed with this independence creates this really exciting dynamic atmosphere where it's like, don't tell me what to do, but I will do whatever you need to help you if you need me. And so what you had is these young people moving up in the 70s meeting these native Vermonters that had been farming, whose own kids, remember, do not want to have anything to do with the farm. This is a generalization I'm making, but you're starting to get the story here. So these young folks, they don't know how to milk cows, they don't know how to cut firewood, they don't know how to plow, they don't know how to do any of this stuff. And of course, these native Vermonters, this is what they've been doing their whole life. And so they are teaching these back-to-the-landers, but with them bring these crazy ideas like cooperatives and organic and growing vegetables and making yogurt and milking, God forbid, goats. And so Into the Hills was spiked with this very interesting assortment of excited people that had the same work ethic and so garnered the same respect from these traditional Vermonters that were there. Now, they continued to grow and expand, but many of them, in fleeing the Vietnam War and fleeing many things, didn't want to have as much to do with the bigger world. Business was bad, big was bad, profit was bad. So their businesses certainly did well and thrived, but they didn't grow, and they didn't have that ambition for them to grow. But even as recently, even as long ago as about 15 years ago, we had more organic farmers in our immediate area per capita than anywhere else in the world. So you had this really strong foundation. Now comes the mid-90s. These back-to-the-landers and the Vermonters and everyone that was sort of feeling hopeful about this town again had been starting to have kids, of course. And these kids were in their 20s and started to take over the farms or start their own agricultural businesses. But now there isn't so much of this profit is bad and big is bad. You can have a mission-based business. You can have a business that is connected to the community and has this social and environmental mission. And these were things that now we know of as common, but 30 years ago, it was very incongruous. And in many circles, it is still very incongruous. So what you've got now is this new generation of food and agricultural-based entrepreneurs that are growing their businesses. Remember I said that there were about 400 or 500 jobs in this town. Well, in the last 3 years, about 150 new jobs have been created that are all value-added agricultural jobs. The four biggest employers in our town are Sustainable Agriculture College, a creamery, a cheese artisan cheese aging facility, and an organic seed company. So these are folks that are employing, 30 to 50 people each. So we're not talking about huge businesses. But again, this is something that I think what's appropriate for our area is these small, medium-sized businesses that are in a similar sector that can support and work with each other. So what's been happening there is that we've begun to think about our food system in a very different way. And so now we've got these graphics and these charts and these strategies around how to understand what a real healthy and complete food system looks like. You start with the soil. Seeds, production, processing and distribution and transportation of it. And then after it gets eaten, wherever it gets eaten, whatever scraps are left over, of course, need to get composted and go back to the soil. This is a full biological system. And so what we're striving to do is to identify where those gaps might be in that, pour energy and resources into those, and seek out the opportunities for either new businesses or new ventures that will dovetail well with it is already there, or that fulfill a need that some of the other companies might already have. that they're now getting from somewhere else. And so because we've been thinking about this and talking about it and working on it in a strategic way, and it's been so collaborative, and again, I think because these little bugs like E. coli and Salmonella and a few other things have raised people's awareness about this, what we've found in the last year and a half is a lot of media attention. And I don't know if any of you have heard of Hardwick before now, but nobody in Hardwick thinks anybody should care about what's happening in Hardwick. Why would they? This has been a dying town for most of the last 70 years. So there's been a culture even of, oh, it's nothing good's coming out of this town. All the jokes, all the this, all the that, nothing ever good is coming out of here. And so people are holding their heads a little bit higher now, but are shocked to see Dan Rather come into town to do a story. Like, are you serious? Dan Rather is here to do a story about Hardwick? They don't know what to think. But he was here just 5 or 6 days ago. So we've been written up in the New York Times and Gourmet Magazine and PBS and all these different things. CBC even did a couple of stories in the radio. And it's been interesting for all of us to get launched onto this national or international stage and to realize how unique and special what we've got is and how important it is. This is a story that's not just important for our town and for what's happening there, but it can hopefully be a tipping point or light a fire in other communities elsewhere. And we definitely don't have very many answers at all. I think a healthy food system, a locally based healthy food system, by definition, is going to be unique everywhere. It's going to respond to the needs of that community, the land of that community, the food culture of that community. And so this is not something that's going to be like a cookie cutter that the Hardwick model gets imposed upon every town all over the place. Heck, we're a town of 3,000 people, and the surrounding towns all have like 500 or 1,000 people in them. We have this interesting history that I just told you about, with the granite industry and then it dying and then back to the landers. That's a very unique history. Every place is going to have its own history, its own strengths, and its own weaknesses. But the inspiration, I think, that can come from tasting the real tomato in Hardwick or here or in your community or anywhere else, I think can be really, really helpful. A few more things that I wanted to talk about. There's some important pieces to how this new food system is going to get figured out. We need basically every idea out there. We are new at this, meaning that this first food system that we created 10,000 years ago, we certainly did with no intention whatsoever. It just happened. Even starting a couple hundred years ago, the industrial food system is not something that was done with a whole lot of intention, except for some of the corporations in the last century that have had more of a strategy along those lines. But now, we have the first opportunity to really create a food system intentionally, knowing what the stakes are and knowing how important it is that we do it well and we do it right. And we cannot fund the new food system with the same mechanisms or the same way that we funded the old food system, because we will get the same old problems again. And I'm just going to go into this briefly because I think that the funding piece of this is really, really critical. What's happened in the United States, and I think in Canada as well, is that many quickly growing companies have followed this venture capital model that is based on the sort of the dot-com era of software companies, where every 3 to 5 years the company sells. And that's how the investors make some money. The companies might not even be profitable. Amazon.com posted its first profit 2 years ago. They've been around for a long time. And there's people that have made millions. They haven't made a penny until 2 years ago as an actual company on the bottom line. But the way that it works is that shares are bought and sold, whether it's publicly traded or privately held. A company flipping every 3 to 5 years is how investors make their money out of it. But if you are a place-based company or a mission-based company, what do you think are the first things that go out the window when you sell? You get consolidated and put
put somewhere else, so your place
is no longer where it started, and the mission is gone. Some cases it's preserved a little bit, kind of more like a tourist attraction mission, not like a real authentic mission. I think independently owned and operated and governed businesses are critical because they do not have the ties to these larger corporations. They do not necessarily have the ties to stakeholders that are forcing them to earn a profit and forcing them to provide the greatest return possible to them. What we need is a broader understanding of what profit and returns means, and we need to realize that the soil can only yield so much. And if you ask more of it than what is realistic, you get the mess we're in now. And so there are many creative strategies that are being used out there, and we can, you know, get into that more if people have specific questions about it. But I'm very proud of my neighbors and businesses in our area because they have actually not just in the agricultural realm garnered attention for themselves, but in the creative investment and creative fundraising realm. These are private companies figuring out how to get the capital they need to grow and expand, yet remain locally based, sustainably based, and locally owned. And it's not an easy thing to do. So right now in the U.S., there are about 2,000 organic companies, organic-minded companies, natural foods or whatever, but like started by real founders, not by someone who invented them like Nantucket Nectars, Tom and Tom. There are no Tom and Tom. So these are like authentic, real companies that are in the $2 million to $10 million size right now. That is gangly teenager size for a company. They cannot afford most of what they're doing, yet they need to invest more because if they're growing quickly, they need to not be in crisis management mode all the time, but be able to do things proactively. So what that means is that those 2,000 companies are prime candidates to get gobbled up by guess who? Cargill, Coca-Cola, you name them. And they are. They're gobbling them up. If we don't have an investment strategy or a way for those companies to still be able to grow and stay locally based, providing local jobs, buying from local farmers and suppliers for making whatever it is they're making, then we're just going to end up with the same old thing where every week you realize that that great juice you were buying at the store is now owned by Coca-Cola and not the little guy anymore, and the jobs leave and the products leave. And it shifts from being organic to being natural. And, you know, we all know what that means. So the funding piece is really, really critical. And we need banks involved. We need angel investors, socially minded investors involved. We need people with $5 and $5,000 and $5 million and $50 million to do this.
And that was Tom Stearns, speaking in September 2009 in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. Tom is the president of High Mowing Seeds, an organic seed company based in Hardwick, Vermont. You can learn more about his company at highmowingseeds.com. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio, and recorded this week at CKDU, Halifax, Nova Scotia. I've been your host, John Steinman. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.